Chapter 38. Skin of Their Teeth. Iwell Province, 30 miles from Keelan. Dennis Vega's serious worry began when Kildorn's rear scouts reported in.
"It's a large Nothani force," said Kildorn. "My men say they're 5 miles behind our last company. Before they were chased away, they confirmed at least a battalion of cavalry, a cannon, and more dust rising behind the units they could see."
"I think we have to assume an Arthani force at least the size of our own," said Dennis. "Our problem is they aren't shepherding 300 slaves.
Major Sixworth, send 2 more riders to the support camp. Tell them to kill the horses if they have to, but get to the camp fast as they can. Warn them we're being pursued by a significant Nathani force and will push our horses to the maximum."
"Do you expect them to send help out from the support camp position?"
"No," said Dennis, who then turned back to Sixwith.
"Your rider should say I'm not asking anyone from the support camp to move forward, only advising them of the situation. While I'm sure they're alert, we don't know that other Nathani or Iwellese aren't headed this way. The camp needs to be ready for whatever happens. Tell them that, at this pace, we'll be 3 or 4 hours behind the riders."
Gulf of Whitlow.
"That was an unpleasant surprise," Brigadier Zeltha remarked.
He stood beside Admiral Culkin, who had returned to the aft castle of Culkin's flagship. The two men had been hailed by one of the cutters picketed to intercept the squadron returning from Swavebrook.
"Yes," Culkin said. "I'm afraid Orkin's gut feeling about our actions may have been too prescient, and we might regret our arguments that convinced him."
"He must be right that the clans had plans in place to respond to our actions. This will almost certainly restrict us from any further land action against the clans. I can still harass them from the sea, but you won't be able to pull enough men away from defensive postures to carry out major actions, as we did at Swavebrook."
"We can still salvage all this," argued Zeltha. "If we can land behind the islanders who reached Ponth, we destroy this group. The clans might not try the same tactic again."
"I wouldn't be optimistic, Ivax. We're 2 hours from where I'll anchor the ships. We'll still have to get the men and cannons ashore. You'll be completely on foot, since we didn't bring any horses back with us."
"All we have to do is set up a blocking position to delay them. Ketton is hot on the trail, and Akuyan wrote that a small Nathani and Iwellese force is racing to get into a flanking position. We can serve as an anvil, but the other two forces hammering the islanders."
Support Base, Iwell Province.
"Well, fuck!"
Yosef exclaimed in English after hearing the writer's message from Dennis. Mulron Lewis didn't need to have the words translated, because he was busy expressing similar sentiments in Kadeli.
"You said there were 2 riders sent," Lewis said, addressing the messenger.
"Where's the other one?" "When we were about halfway, we decided we risked both horses giving out, so we drew sticks and I won. I took both horses, and, about 10 miles back, turned loose the one I was riding and continued on with the second horse. The other rider is on the road, waiting to be picked up."
Lewis groaned.
"Why the damnation did they take along 300 slaves?"
Yosef put a hand on Lewis's shoulder.
"We weren't there, Mulron. I assume the men found them and couldn't bring themselves to leave them as slaves. Not when they had a chance to transport them back."
"Understanding is not the same as approving," Yosef thought to himself. Dennis succumbed to a classic leader fault by letting emotions decide instead of logic. Not that he blamed Dennis.
Yosef was honest enough to admit that in the same situation, he might have done the same. He couldn't bring himself to cast aspersions when he himself might have been guilty of an emotional decision. For 2 days, he'd castigated himself for sending Balwas off to kill the Nathani colonel in Hanslow. In retrospect, he couldn't be sure that pure anger and thirst for revenge at the attack on his home and family hadn't made him too eager to send Balwas and the others. He felt even worse when he learned that Y4 had gone with Balwas, despite having just lost two fingers. The only relevant question now is not why Dennis did what he did, but what should we do? Said Yosef. How are they transporting the slaves? Mainly in wagons from the slave camp or from farms. The messenger replied. Most are overloaded for the number of horses pulling them, and I wouldn't be surprised if some haven't broken down. The rest are riding double with our men. We can't leave this position, said Mulron. We're dug in here, and it's too good a defensive position. Maybe we can send wagons and horses forward to meet Dennis, Yosef suggested. We don't need the wagons we brought. We can dump everything out of them. If the rider is right, our wagons can hold more people, and we have full teams, so the weight of the load won't be a factor. Mulron put his lower lip between his teeth while he chewed over Yosef's proposal. What about men? Yosef asked. We can't just send wagons and drivers. They'll need enough escorts in case they run into Iwalese. Lewis scowled. I hate reducing our strength here. But you're right. The wagons can't go naked. What do you think, one company? I'd rather send two companies, Yosef said. But I've got a bad feeling the Narthani coming after Dennis aren't the only ones we have to worry about. I think we need to send pickets farther north and to our rear just in case. Maybe a company's worth, to be sure nothing slips by them. That leaves us two companies short here, so I think one company is all we can risk sending with the wagons. We should also send a rider to Dennis to alert him that the wagons are coming. It might change how hard he pushes the ones he's got. Kenton.
Colonel, said a young lieutenant with the company leading the column. A forward scout just reported. They've made contact with the islanders. They're only 3 miles ahead of us.
They may be only 3 miles away, but they're also only 15 miles from leaving this flat terrain and getting into Broken Hills, where we wouldn't be able to envelop them.
Not only that, I remember some rock and boulder fields a few miles before that.
That'll make it harder to get around them.
At that point, to stop them from reaching Keelan, we'd have to go straight at them,
and only a fraction of them could defend some position, while the rest escaped.
Lieutenant, get back to your unit and tell the captain to push his horses and make contact with the islanders. Do whatever he can to force them to stop and fight. I'll bring up the rest of our men as fast as I can.
Ketton spun to his staff.
Now that we know exactly how far off they are, we need to pick up the pace. We still have 2 battalions of infantry too far back. Get the drivers to whip the horses continuously if necessary. It's going to be tight. If Zalfa can block the road and force them to try to bypass them, we'll have them. Otherwise, we'll need to force them to stop and fight before they get off this flat land.
What about the Iwalese coming from the north? Asked the captain.
Last word was they should reach the raiding party in the next hour, said Ketton's aide-de-camp.
Dennis.
Get those people into the new wagons, Dennis shouted. Don't ask them to move or offer to help. Carry or throw them if you have to. The damned Narthani are only 2 miles behind us.
Dennis's mind went over Yosef Kolsko's summary of tactical points and leadership issues. The one element he focused on was the necessity for a leader to think calmly and rationally. They were in trouble. Maybe they could make it to Mulron Lewis's position and the prepared defenses, and maybe not. He watched while the rest of the ex-slaves were moved to the larger wagons with bigger horse teams.
If I were Yosef, what would I be thinking? He wondered. I need to think of how to stop the Narthani from attacking our rear without slowing us down. Think.
Think!
What are our advantages?
A platoon of dragoons rode past where they stood.
Horses.
We're all mounted.
The Narthani don't have that many cavalry, so either we might outnumber them, or they're bringing up infantry, maybe in wagons.
They must have artillery.
But with both artillery and infantry, it takes time to deploy. If we can force them to stop and bring up artillery and infantry, then they have to slow down.
Kildorn, Sixwith, here's what we'll do. Kildorn, take 10 of the 6-pounders and set them up about a mile farther from here.
As soon as the Narthani get within range, start with solid shot, and then switch to grape shot as they get closer.
Put 2 companies of dragoons to each flank to keep the Narthani from getting around you easily. To force your position, they'll have to deploy enough men and cannon to take you on. Before that happens, pull out. It'll take them time to reassemble and come on after us.
That'll give them the chance to get cavalry around us,
Sixwith warned. Dennis rubbed a hand over his shaven head.
So far, the scouts report cavalry, though not large formations. We'll have to risk that we have enough mounted men to keep any Narthani cavalry at bay,
while our artillery forces them to deploy their own cannon and infantry.
Sixwith,
move your battalion another mile farther than Kildorn and set up the same as Kildorn does. The 2 of you will take turns setting up new blocking positions, while the other slows the Narthani. We only have to do it a few times to get the wagons to the camp.
Dennis left the men to do their work and pulled Major Kildorn aside.
Kildorn, it's going to be a close call. We're still 8 miles from the camp. If they catch us, at best it'll be a bloody fight to the camp. At worst, we'll have to leave the slaves and save as many of ourselves as possible.
Kildorn's face clouded over, his jaw clenched.
We can't just leave them. We don't know how many Narthani are following. If they catch us, we could still beat them off.
That's not an option,
Dennis stated firmly.
We don't know exactly how many are chasing us. Neither do we know what other forces might try to cut us off, either from the north or landed from ships. We have specific orders not to engage in pitched battles. The purpose of the raid was to throw a scare into the Iwalese and Narthani. We've done that. But for everything to be successful, we have to get back relatively unscathed.
You're right, I know,
said Kildorn, his face taking on a desperate set.
Kildorn looked around to see if anyone was within hearing distance.
Dennis, he said, switching to first names.
If it comes to that, I'll take a company and delay the Narthani as long as possible. Hopefully that will give you enough time to get the rest to safety.
Dennis's throat clenched. He swallowed.
Really? I hate to ask it, but I was going to if you hadn't offered.
That's okay, Dennis.
I remember Kolsko's summary, too. Better to save most than none. If it comes to that, I want you to know, it's been an honor to be on this ride, and I hope I served you well.
The honor is all mine, really.
We may not get a chance to speak again. Things may move so fast. I'll leave it up to you to do what you think is necessary.
Yosef.
He stood on top of a higher butte, 100 feet above the pass. He wore a pair of fox ears on his head. The leather, ear-shaped, foot-wide cup sat over his ears, connected by a strap that held the apparatus on his head. He'd had them made months ago and brought them along on a hunch. They were one of the sporadic ideas that had cropped into his head. He'd been inspired by the memory of seeing an enclosure of African fennec foxes at the San Diego Zoo when he was 9 years old. The little animal's enormous ears for its size made the creature look cartoonish, but visitors to the zoo could put their heads between a fennec ear's mock-up and experience dramatically improved hearing, to the delight of his 9-year-old self. It was as if
his own ears had connected to an amplifier. The sign next to the fennec enclosure said the little fox could hear prey moving underground. The first time he tried the ears in Kernford, he had garnered odd looks until witnesses recognized him. Almost anything he did was accepted by now as probably something important, even if it looked as bizarre as a grown man wearing a pair of giant ears. Standing on the edge of the butte, he held on the fennec ears being assailed by the wind. He could just make out what had to be musket fire. Most of the sounds came from due west, but he also thought occasionally from the northwest. He jerked the ears off his head and raced to a chute that led to the loose gravel of the butte's lower slope. There he jumped out, landed on the loose rock, and let himself slide several yards before he slowed. Then he jumped again. It took 19 seconds to descend the 100 feet, and he arrived, miraculously, in one piece with nothing broken.
"Mulron!" he yelled, running to the command tent. "I can hear them. Firing. Muskets. Can't be more than 3 miles away."
"That close?" questioned Lewis.
"We should have heard it from here. It's these hills and broken terrain. The sound probably passes over."
Lewis looked west. He couldn't hear anything, but if Yosef were right,
"I can't risk taking too many men from this position. But the 12-pounders aren't best used here because the hills restrict the firing lanes. A mile and a half west is a boulder field where the flatland begins. The 12-pounders would have clear firing lanes and might outgun anything the Narthani cavalry brought with them. I can take the 12-pounders in one company, if we hurry. I can set up in time to support Dennis, if he gets that far. It's the best I can see to help."
"Oh, shit," thought Yosef. "Why does this always seem to happen to me at these times?"
"You can't go, Mulron. You're in command here, and we can't afford any command confusion. It'll have to be me who takes the cannon forward. Anyway, I'm most familiar with them, so I'm the logical person."
Kedon. Musket fire came in clusters. A dozen, a score, 100 shots were heard in rapid succession. They trailed off to nothing for minutes, before beginning again. Kedon couldn't see the action, but it wasn't more than a half a mile away. A captain galloped from the direction of the firing and reined in his horse near Ketton's mount, which jumped aside.
"Major Torvik's compliments, Colonel. He says they haven't been able to close with the islanders. It's the same as they've been doing for the past few hours. They deploy their 6-pounders if we get too close and pull them out before our own cannon can get forward. We tried again to send a cavalry company around them, but their horsemen outnumber us. We're out of the sand and clay terrain and into broken gravel and rocks. The horses have a harder time trying to flank the islanders before they pull out again. Major Torvik says unless the footing gets better, or we can get our cannon deployed faster, the only way he sees overtaking them is a straight-out charge and absorbing the resulting casualties."
Kedon used the time to settle his horse to consider the captain's news. The prospects weren't good.
"No, Captain. We can't go trading one for one with the islanders. They outnumber us, and we'd run out of men before they would. Tell Major Torvik to do the best he can to break through their rear guard. Also, tell him that the Iwalese are supposed to have already hit the islanders' flank. If it's going to happen, it must be soon. That might provide enough of a distraction and diversion of their men that you can break through."
"Yes, Colonel. The Major was wondering if we'd heard any news about Brigadier Zalfa."
"Nothing yet. They should arrive any moment."
Kedon didn't mention he'd been expecting Zalfa and his men to have blocked the islanders at any moment for the last 2 hours. Zalfa.
"I don't think you're going to make it, Ivax," said Kalkan, watching the first 2 troop ships lowering longboats to row infantry ashore. The road lay only 2 miles from the beach.
Pickets reported musket and cannon fire to the northwest.
You're probably right, but we need to try. I wish we could also get the cannon to shore faster.
The only way would be to beach the transport carrying the cannon, hack a hole in the side, and pull the cannon out onto the beach. We can patch the ship later and tow it off the beach. I'm willing to give the order if you think you'd have a good chance to trap the islanders.
Zulfus had swiveled to look at Culkin.
Beach one of your ships?
I thought all you naval types were in love with the things.
Even lumbering ones like troop ships.
The Admiral's eyes twinkled.
I didn't say I was giving one up. Only temporarily stationing it on shore. I have enough carpenters on the other ships that we can get the hole plugged in ours.
I checked our charts and tide records.
The beaching would be before low tide, so when the hole is repaired enough, we'd pull her off at high tide.
Zalfa considered the idea for only a few seconds.
Let's do it, Morfrid. There's no worry about getting the cannon back aboard. We'll let Ketton take them when he gets to us.
Dennis. Six with reined in next to Dennis and Kildorn.
My company to the north continues to skirmish with the riders coming south. Lots of them, hundreds. I'll send another company of dragoons to slow them more. They don't seem all that eager to attack, so I think we can hold them off long enough to get to the camp.
Dennis cursed.
Must be Iwilese. As far as we know, there's no Narthani stationed this far south in Iwil, and I doubt they could have come from Pretty. How far off?
They're coming overland, no roads, said Sixwith. There are enough gullies and rock fields that I think we can slow them down for 30 or 40 minutes, no matter how many there are.
How fortunate for us, then, said Dennis. We'll be at the support camp before they get here.
How can you be sure about that?
Because we have to, replied Dennis.
So far, Kildor and I have been able to slow them enough, said Sixwith. But it's getting dicier. Either from practice or by changing procedures, they're getting their artillery into play faster each time.
Maybe it's that time,
said Kildorn, referring to his offer to take the company and delay the Narthani as long as possible.
Thanks, Regali, but I think we're going to make it without going to that extreme.
Yosef.
They set up the four 12-pounders 30 yards off the road, two cannon north and two south of the road. From their position, they had a small elevation advantage of the road west. Yosef dealt with the cannon while the company commander deployed most of his men frantically digging and piling rocks to provide minimal protection. They rolled some because they were too heavy to lift. 10 men kept the horses in a draw out of shot exposure, and 5 men were sent as pickets north and south to warn of flanking attempts. Sounds of sporadic musket and 6-pounder firings came closer by the minute. 80 men were still digging when the first of Dennis's dragoons, 2 companies, Yosef estimated, came racing down the road. They passed without slowing, waving in relief and greeted with cheers by the men Yosef had brought forward. Following the last dragoons were wagons careening down the road, first visible 500 yards away, each wagon filled with people hanging on. Harried drivers so intently urged their horses on that they didn't notice the makeshift entrenchments until almost on top of the cannon and the company. The driver of the first wagon started to rein in panic until he recognized clansmen, then he lashed the horses. The wagon's occupants only stared as they flashed past Yosef, their fear palpable, though he didn't know whether it was from the Narthani or the wagon ride. Yosef shook his head. Dennis was the man on the spot, and slowing down to rescue these people had been a risk. Yosef was glad he hadn't been the one making the decision. The last 2 wagons carried wounded clansmen. Yosef estimated no more than 12.
I hope that means not many dead. I don't believe Dennis would have left wounded behind.
More mounted clansmen rode past, 2 companies by Yosef's estimate. He stood on a mound and saw the first signs of fighting, smoke from muskets and 6-pounders,
then horses, he thought, and maybe men. But he couldn't make out what they were doing. Damn, I left my telescope back at the support camp. Finally, he saw a cluster of men galloping in his direction. One rider carried the green Cadellium flag he'd designed. Another carried a banner. Dennis's command flag. Relief washed over Yosef. Dennis was okay, and they would reach safety. When Dennis made it to their position, Yosef and the company commander stood off the road waiting. Dennis pulled up, took one look at Yosef, and started to say something, then closed his mouth and jumped off his horse. I bet he was about to say, "What the fuck are you doing here?" Dennis didn't waste time.
"I'll set up two companies and half of my six-pounders on the next rise."
He pointed to the small hill that the road disappeared over, about 300 yards away.
"They won't be able to see if we've got another position farther from here, until they get to the top after we withdraw. As soon as we're ready, you pull out and get back to the camp."
Yosef noted that Dennis hadn't ordered him back to the support camp. Orders about me staying out of action or not, Dennis deals with the moment, and at this moment, I'm manning the 12-pounders. The company commander ran off, yelling orders to his men and sending runners to pull in the pickets and several men to those holding the horses. "I see many of your men are riding double," said Yosef.
"We didn't have any stand-up fights, but it's been long-distance sniping and occasional probes by their lead units at our blocking positions. We lose a few horses every time we withdraw the blocking companies. Horses are too big of targets not to hit a few. Fortunately, not many men have been hit. The six-pounders kept the Narthani cautious. Only once did they manage to bring up their cannon before we pulled back, which was fortunate, since their cannon seemed to outrange our six-pounders. I couldn't see details, but by telescope I got the impression they were somewhere between our six- and 12-pounders. That one time we lost a cannon, several limbers, and five dead before we got out of range.
Damn. The Narthani didn't have anything like that at Moreland City. We're casting our own, and certainly they know the craft better than we do. So it's hardly a surprise if they're putting out new cannon. We can't assume we'll always outgun them if they make something bigger, especially for fixed defenses. Damn.
I'll finish seeing the next position set up, said Dennis. Then I'll be back here to see this position withdraw, and you will get your ass back to the base camp.
I guess he didn't forget his orders after all. Yosef didn't argue, being relieved and chagrined at the same time. 40 minutes later, Dennis joined the last men to withdraw to the support camp's position between buttes. Mulron Lewis had already sent the wagons with rescued slaves and the wounded on to Keelan, accompanied by four companies of worn-out dragoons.
"There's not enough room here for all the men to be useful," Lewis said to Dennis. "I think we can start another three or four companies back, but I wanted to check with you first."
Dennis perused the position. The 12-pounders Yosef had moved forward were being wheeled back into their original dug-in positions. Digging had gone on since the support force arrived, and by now, an impressive layout of trenches would allow every musket man to stand upright to reload, then use a step in the trench to fire. They had positioned Dennis's six-pounders 50 yards to the rear and on higher ground. Yosef noticed the object of Dennis's gaze.
"The six-pounders are a backup in the unlikely case the Narthani attack our position and break through. They can also be seen from where the Narthani could come at us, which should help discourage them."
"Here they come!"
shouted a voice, and every man turned to look west. A triple line of infantry fanned out across the 400 yards of the flat plain alongside the road. More men appeared in the smaller buttes on both sides. Yosef could see cannon being pulled forward and crews detaching them from limbers and wheeling them to face the islanders. The infantry line moved 50 yards, then stopped and knelt. Behind them came a score or more of cavalry, and then a group of men, one of whom carried a large red flag, and other men held banners. Dennis, Lewis, and Yosef all used telescopes to scrutinize the Narthani.
They're not coming on, said Lewis.
Yet, anyway.
I recognize one of the banners, Dennis said. We saw it several times since sunrise. What's the other one?
That's a new one.
Lewis turned and spoke to a man standing behind him. The man ran off.
Dennis, one of the slaves you brought back wouldn't leave. He seems to be something of a leader and insisted he stay, in case he could do anything to help kill Narthani. Half a dozen men joined him, and I had them carrying water to our people. I've sent for him. Maybe he recognizes the banners.
What are they doing just sitting there?
Dennis said more to himself than asking for answers. Then his voice changed.
Are you sure there's no way to get around behind us?
Not quickly, said Lewis. Their infantry could eventually work their way to our rear, but it would take a good part of a day. We don't plan to be here any longer than necessary. I think we're all secure now. Even if they follow us as we pull out, there's no way to get ahead of us.
Here we go, said Lewis, as the man he'd sent off returned with a scrawny, middle-aged man with fire in his eyes.
Lanwen, we're seeing Narthani banners. I think one is for whoever is leading the pursuit. A second one showed up that I haven't seen before. Would you recognize them?
Lewis handed over his telescope.
I worked on the docks for a year before they sent me outside Ponth to be a farm slave.
I probably saw most of the banners of the top Narthani.
Lanwen put the eyepiece to his right eye and closed the left eye.
The big red flag tells you they're Narthani. Blood red with two crossed swords. One of them is supposed to be the traditional weapon where they came from, the other one what they currently use. Then there are personal banners for the most senior officers.
Yeah. The one on the right is for Colonel Ketun. I think his first name is Erkin. He's the commander of the Narthani soldiers in Predi province, and some kind of engineer. I've heard from slaves coming from Predi city the last few months that there's been a frenzy of construction going on. Trenches and fortifications.
I can't make out the other banner. The wind's got it coiled around the staff.
Wait.
The man holding it is untangling it.
There, it's waving.
Well, what do you know?
It's Zalfa's banner.
Zalfa?
Queried Dennis.
Brigadier Ivak Zalfa. He's the top army commander. General Akuyan is also army, but he's in overall charge of all Narthani, military and civilians. Zalfa is the officer who directly commands the army on Cadelium.
That's odd, said Yosef. I can see this Ketun being on the scene, if he were dispatched from Predi to deal with us, but his commander showing up only later? Unless... oh, hell. I'll bet he showed up by ship and brought a shitload more soldiers with him.
Could they have put that much together so fast? Asked Lewis.
They could only have gotten word of what we were doing a couple of days ago.
In that time, they gathered men, got them on ships, and tried to block our way back?
Possibly, said Yosef. Remember, this is a professional army.
However, there's another possibility. If this Zalfa led the Swaybrook attack, it could be they were returning, or had already returned to Predi City and got diverted toward us.
Dennis spat to one side.
That doesn't make me feel too good.
That would mean we'd missed being trapped between two forces by maybe an hour, perhaps minutes.
Whatever happened, we're safe now from direct attacks. They can't get around us anymore before we reach Dornfeld, said Yosef. It wouldn't surprise me if the general pursuit is over, and they just tail us to be sure we leave Iwal territory.
Ketun and Zalfa.
Look at the bastards, Erkin. That bunch under the green flag.
standing there looking at us through their telescopes.
As you are doing to them, Ivax,
said the older man.
If I was them, I'd be taking a break after being pushed so hard these last 50-60 miles. And why not rest? They must know they've gotten away from us. There's no way we can force the position they're in. Not with no room to maneuver and how it looks like they're dug in. We have to accept they're going to get away with the raid.
Zalfa glared at Ketten, who returned his look calmly.
All right, Erkan. I know you're right. I'm just irked that we missed them. Kalkin's not going to be pleased either. He offered, and I accepted, that he beached the transport ship carrying our cannon. He had his men cut a hole in the side to get the cannon out. They should be halfway here, with men on foot pulling them with ropes and manually turning the spokes. First it was through a couple hundred yards of sand, then over this damned rocky ground. Now I have to tell the men it was all for nothing.
And tell them to turn around and take the cannon back to shore to what? Put them on another ship?
No. Kalkin says they'll have the hull repaired and tow the transport off the beach at high tide. You'll take the cannon by road back to Pretty City.
Which I suppose I should start my staff organizing. All right. We'll take your cannon. There's no rush now. I'll have two cavalry companies shadow the islanders and be sure they leave Iwal territory, unless you think there's still a chance to make them stand and fight where we can maneuver.
No. No chance that I see. Your two companies are more than enough to keep eyes on them. Let's head back to Brady.